and welcome to Everybody Likes Music. I'm James, and as always, I'm joined by my good friend Ben.
Hello.
And this week, our special guest is Dave Richards. Hello, Dave. How are you?
Pretty good, thanks.
So, Dave, you work down at RISC, which is the Reading International Solidarity Centre. Do you want to just talk a little bit about what the organisation is and what they actually do?
Yeah. So, RISC is an educational charity that's been going since the mid-80s. So, it really started out as a response to Bob Geldof and the whole Band-Aid sort of bandwagon. And the message that it was putting out was that, you know, people are starving because of the weather, basically. And our project really started on a double-decker bus going around Berkshire, just raising awareness about what the true causes of that Ethiopian famine was, that at the same time that Ethiopia was exporting green beans, people were starving. So it was all about equity. You know, why was it that people didn't have access to the food that was being produced in the country? And just really unpicking about the real causes of global inequality and poverty. And so that was the impetus. And we then moved to Reading in 1987. And I joined the organisation in 89. So I've been around a little while. And it's really sort of transformed from those early days. We had a shop front on London Street. And then as the project became more and more successful, we got more and more funding, particularly from the European Union, long may it rest. And we then moved down to the present site, which you'd be familiar with in London Street, and really developed as a community hub, with education, with a cafe, the World Shop, and a world-famous roof garden, which you also know. So, you know, it's really come on in leaps and bounds. And you know, right at the beginning, back in the 80s, who would have thought that it could become sort of such a part of the town's social, cultural, political landscape?
One of the actually, with one of your five tracks that you gave us, we'll talk about a lot of them a lot later, but Bob Geldof was one of your picks. How do you think music plays a role in politics and protest and you know, environments and human rights? How does it play a part?
I think there's so many examples of how musicians have responded to the challenges of the time. And so, I mean, Bob Geldof was one. I mean, I think it's rather unfortunate in some ways that it just kind of reinforced all kinds of stereotypes about Africa, all sorts of stereotypes about the real, the solution to Africa's problems is in our charity. And that's the complete antithesis of what we're trying to say at RISC, that we actually need to make a more equitable world trading system in order to address that kind of poverty. But I mean, there are other kind of examples. So one of my other picks is Naina Cherry and Usain Dor, 7 Seconds. And this was a big hit in the 80s. You know, in three different languages, in Wolof, in French, and then in English. And, you know, this was talking about, you know, a newborn child and you know, innocent, how would it know about all the kinds of things that it was going to face in its lifetime? And that was part of Peter Gabriel's tour for Amnesty International, which really sort of highlighted this kind of crossover between sort of world music and then pop, you know, Peter Gabriel. And there are other people who are on that tour, like Tracy Chapman, you know, is very much sort of raising awareness about all kinds of issues, gender, race, class, all that kind of stuff. And so I think, you know, there's no end of examples of musicians who've responded. And 7 Seconds is also, for me, kind of summarizes RISC's involvement with WOMAD, because that came to Rivermead, that came to Reading. I think it was in the 90s, and RISC was involved right from the beginning. We had a world tent, and this was a way of showcasing a lot of the local organisations that were part of our international forum. And so we would run a whole series of workshops as part of WOMAD, on all kinds of human rights issues. So whether it was modern day slavery, we could get local organisations who were doing forum theatre, so it became a very sort of creative process. All kinds of local bands were also part of the One World stage. We have highlights, you know, that we had speakers from the Palestine Liberation Organization, lots of people from Amnesty. George Monbiot, famous sort of Guardian journalist, was also speaking. Vanessa Redgrave was talking about human rights as well. So that track really sort of resonates with Risk's whole experience with world music. And as a result of that, I was lucky enough to get a backstage pass and indulge my interest in photography and have a huge archive of a lot of the musicians. And we turned that into a teaching resource. So just looking at the worlds behind the music, just, you know, that there's all this world music, which at that time was really becoming a bit of a thing. You know, you could go to the record shop and see the label World Music. But it was just to show that this was more than just sort of funky, you know, exotic dance music, that actually a lot of these musicians were talking about issues of poverty, about, you know, unfair world trade, human rights, all those kind of things. And also especially gender. I mean, that was another thing that was being flagged up. And so we just produced this teaching resource for schools, for teachers, to begin to, again, to unpick the kind of messages in popular music.
Just quickly, I just need to correct Ben, because he got his Bobs mixed up.
Oh, it's Bob Dylan.
Bob Dylan, not Bob Geldof. Yeah. I was just intrigued by sort of the label World Music, because it's quite a generalised label. Do you think that we should sort of more be heading for sort of an era where we can actually label all of these, say, in a record store, you know, all of these with actually, you know, the cultures that they come from? Because what do you think about sort of the label World Music?
You're absolutely right. I mean, it was just a number of, you know, some of the record labels that were getting into that whole sort of strand of music at the time came up with this marketing. Basically, it's a marketing ploy. And there's all kinds of side issues about how music from other cultures has been taken over, has been monetized by mainly Western music interest in the music industry. And, you know, so, I mean, for example, you know, our rock music, you know, has sort of taken black popular music from the States and has kind of, you know, turned it, has actually, you know, a lot of the money, for example, that Elvis made was on the back of, you know, traditional sort of rock and roll from the southern US. And so there's lots of examples about how the real benefits of this kind of culture has been sort of taken over by the music industry. So that is a legitimate sort of question. And I think what's interesting is that some musicians like Usundor, you know, have set up their own recording studios, have set up their own independent sort of distribution of in the music industry. But still, the big names are still in the West. So you're absolutely right, but you know, I'm not sure that, you know, the niceties of Afrobeat or, you know, the particular sort of genre, and there are so many. I mean, it is so rich, this whole kind of culture. And what's, I think, interesting now is the fusion that's sort of taken place. And obviously WOMAD was part of that. It brought lots of musicians together for the festivals, and there were all kinds of really fantastic sort of collaborations. And I think, you know, the whole of world culture, if you like, you know, quite apart from music, is about fusion. It's about how, you know, cultures, for all kinds of reasons, mainly trade, mainly after, you know, making money, trying to make a living, as well as empire, you know, brought all these kind of strands of culture together. And the result has been this sort of amazing richness, which, you know, we're really, really lucky to be able to consume. And, you know, hopefully, I mean, and part of that whole kind of Worlds Behind Music teaching resource was just trying to get people to see the kind of power relations behind the music industry.
You've also chosen a Miles Davis track, So What. Now,
absolute
jazz,
classic as well.
Yeah. and jazz in itself, I suppose, is something that's you know, certainly evolved a lot and changed with a lot of other sort of genres and cultural influences coming in. What was it about that track that sort of made you choose it in your five tracks?
I fell in love with Miles Davis and that particular album because it's so cool. I mean, it's just, I mean, what's not to like about Kind of Blue? You know, I mean, I think definitely one of my all-time favorite albums. And I guess, as you know, I mean, I was at school in the 60s, uni at the 70s, so it was very much of the time, and it was a way into the whole richness of jazz, and then subsequently, you know, realize the whole story of jazz is from its roots in the southern USA. And what's interesting then is how the whole of black music and its influence on Western pop music and Western music generally, you know, how so many of those jazz artists came to Europe after the Second World War because, ironically, you know, it, coming to Europe, they were received in a much more positive way than they were in the States. And, you know, people like Miles, based in Paris, you know, really having a much more appreciation of his music. And there's so many other, you know, American jazz musicians who made that journey across the Atlantic. And so that's really fascinating. And obviously in the UK, you know, lots of the Caribbean migrants brought over those kind of traditions. And then the kind of fusion with Caribbean music, I just think has been so, so rich. And as I said before, you know, we're the lucky beneficiaries of that fusion.
So as part of Risk, you do something called Food for Families. Do you want to talk a little bit about how that goes along with everything you do at Risk at the centre?
Yeah, I mean, one of the big themes, obviously, from the, you know, the famine in East Africa in the mid-80s, food and food issues, food sovereignty, food poverty have been a key element of the issues that we're trying to raise. And so in 2000, we had the unexpected possibility of creating a roof garden above our conference hall. And that just fortuitously turned into a real feature that because it was planted according to permaculture principles, it was an edible forest before they became a bit of a thing in sustainable gardening circles. We discovered that the whole world was interested, particularly around sustainable urban design, all those kind of things. So lots of people were interested in the roof garden. And on the back of that, we managed to get lottery funding to create 15 community gardens in Reading. And this was all part of a whole kind of program in order to encourage more local food production. You know, food miles, all those kind of issues were quite current. So in 2010, we got three-year funding to set up all these gardens. And that was really successful. We worked we created gardens in schools, community centres, and then we also worked with Reading Borough Council on some of their sort of land, which was problematic, was being used for fly tipping, sort of tucked in behind some houses. And so we took over those sites, cleared it, created community gardens, and created a problem into a community asset. And we've just gone from success to success. That we got further funding. We've now created over 25 gardens around town. We're part of sort of national and international networks around community gardening. For example, just earlier in the year, I was part of an international symposium on forest gardens, just sort of relaying the experience that we've got here in Reading to a wider audience and trying to promote this kind of approach to both sustainable urban design with the climate crisis and also as a way of growing more local food.
Do you think that there's any role that music specifically can play in helping with those community projects, with gardens, with education that you haven't yet exploited or really do love to use?
I mean, I think in all celebration, music has a part. We haven't, so we have events at our gardens because the whole idea is to get more and more people involved, and that the garden becomes a bridge within the community. And I think there's so much evidence now that, you know, particularly post-COVID, the need for green space, but also the need to address issues of loneliness, mental health, well-being, all those kind of things. And so for me, as we go forward and we're looking this year, during the summer, we've got funding for the Freedom Food Fest, so appropriate, coming out of COVID, encouraging those people who might be a bit anxious about sort of stepping out to actually come to our gardens where they can be outdoors, reduce sort of COVID risk, but meeting with people and just enjoying the whole sort of process of growing, harvesting, cooking and eating food, and that whole kind of social process of sharing. And for me, you know, we'll try and build in sort of music into that. And certainly in our gardens, we're looking to encourage kids to be doing things like percussion workshops and that kind of thing. And also a lot of my garden designs, so I try and build in opportunities for example, wind chimes. And also, some cultural traditions, you know, they have percussion on log drums in Africa. And what I'd really like to do one day is to create a pit drum. So you dig a pit, you cover it with some kind of skin, and then that becomes a tool for percussion. So all kinds of ideas, as yet not quite realised, but definitely realising that, you know, the music has a key part in all of human existence. It, for me, it's kind of hardwired into the human being, and it also marks so many sort of key stages of our lives. And so, you know, it's a tool which we can use just to get people involved. And certainly at risk, you know, we find that music is a good way of engaging with people.
It's certainly something that I hadn't considered. You sort of completely forget that wind chimes themselves, they create beautiful music, and they can become integral parts of gardens and an outdoor space. And it's amazing to think of the ideas that you can, the possibilities that I don't think people really think about unless they really knuckle down. And
I suppose without getting too sort of cliche at all, it's also just sort of being in the garden. It's the sounds of nature and the idea of nature itself.
And so in my designs, I try to create that kind of soundscape. So, you know, planting, for example, bamboos, that when the wind blows, they rattle together and create that. And obviously the use of water is really, really important as well. So you're absolutely right, James, that's important. But I just remember the first time when I realised this was in Helsinki, because I'm a bit of a fan of Sibelius, and there's a monument to him in this park in town, and they've got this amazing sculpture which is basically a series of tubes of different lengths, and as the wind blows you get all these sort of tones and intertones and everything else. And that really made me think, so one day in one of our gardens we'll do that.
That would be wonderful. That brings me quite nicely on then to some more of your tracks. So you've also chosen a piece by Marla. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I discovered Marla a long time ago when I used to look after a disabled guy, and we would make pilgrimages to London and the Festival Hall, and he introduced me to Marla. So it's his second symphony, The Resurrection. And it was just magical, the whole new sort of musical language for me. And then as I explored it, this track, I mean, every time I hear it, it just makes me melt. I mean, it's just so achingly beautiful. There's a kind of a melancholic sort of part of my musical taste, and so, you know, some of his songs really respond to that. And then more recently, since I've had kids, I've got two daughters who are both really into music, both sang as part of the Berkshire Youth Choir. One of my daughters is a choral scholar, and so this kind of really represents that whole kind of soundscape of the female voice that for me sort of resonates with my kids as well as my sort of voyage of discovery in music.
And so talking about sort of singing as well, you've got some John Rutter on there. So as Pierre Jesu Requiem, is that a similar sort of idea with?
Yeah, yeah. So you know, through my daughters, I a whole new area of music, you know, the unaccompanied music, a cappella, you know, because of the Berkshire Youth Choir, and then they went on to the National Youth Choir. And my youngest, this was her audition piece to become a choral scholar at Cambridge. And I realised, we always used to tease her that she never did enough practice compared with my first daughter. And we were remorseless in taking the mickey out of her. And in preparing for that audition, this was her piece. And I heard her singing it in the audition, and I was just in pieces. She really, really nailed it, and she got the place. So yeah, this is always associated with that, and it's again an achingly beautiful piece.
We've been talking quite a bit, actually, since doing this podcast about how certain pieces...
They can really mark points in your life, can't they? And they're very powerful. That you don't really think about it until you listen to the music again and it takes you back.
And would you say it's that idea that kind of if you do listen to it, it sort of makes you think of, say, your daughter or, you know, what she's doing, or just... Or is it just more than that?
I mean, I was always disposed to this kind of melancholic type of music, and obviously with, you know, with children, how they enrich your lives. And then this was an unexpected, you know, I mean, we never realised that they would be taking to singing, you know, sort of so wholeheartedly, and how it really enriches their lives, but also ours, you know. And it's been, as I say, you know, discovery, you know, extending into whole new repertoire, whole new soundscape. But yeah, I mean, music is, I think, fundamental to you know, my own, how I sort of map my life and everything else. So it's fundamental.
To what sort of point would you say that music has actually shaped or influenced who you are as a person, or say the way you view the world? Do you think it's had a big impact on that?
I think it's been sort of an emotional support. So, I mean, obviously it's entertainment, you know, I can sort of tap my feet to the Beatles or whatever else. And what's interesting is that, you know, there's so many musics where they seem familiar, but I don't remember ever listening to them. So they're all part of your soundscape, whether it was on the radio or whatever. And I realised was my mum, who is from Singapore, she was very much into things like Oklahoma and those kind of things. I never recall, you know, listening to them, but when I hear it, I'm suddenly sort of transported to that world. And so, you know, it's interesting how we just kind of absorb this stuff, maybe unconsciously, or Motown. You know, I mean, I didn't particularly like Motown at the time when it came on Top of the Pops, you know. But then, you know, when I hear the Four Tops or Diana Ross now, it's there, and it's so familiar. It's part of me, as well as then the things which I, you know, got out of the record library or nowadays, you know, check out on Spotify. That for me is the fantastic thing about music, is that, you know, it never stops. And, you know, as I sort of discover more about it, you know, that 40,000 years ago, you know, the first musical instruments have been found, which date back to that time, you know, hollowed out sort of vulture bones that were used as a flute, and, you know, the whole of that kind of existence since then, you know, music has been part of that. Yeah, after all, it goes back to our heartbeat, doesn't it? You know, that bass, that boom, 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 that is sort of core to our existence. So, yeah, sure. it's fundamental.
I love that music is core to our existence. It is. It runs in our heart.
It's why everybody does like music. There's no excuse. They have to.
So, unfortunately, I really love this interview, but unfortunately that is just about all we've got time for. So just for our listeners, where can they find Risk, the main sort of centre in Reading?
So we're on London Street. So if you cross the Kennet at Duke Street and then just continue out of town, the fine sort of Georgian houses on London Street. We're at towards the bottom, next door to Great Expectations Hotel Pub. And we have a distinctive shop front, blue, and a bit of terracotta. And look out for the Global Cafe and World Shop. Although now it's not so much of a cafe, unlike the times when you performed there. We've turned that space into a refill shop, so people can come and get their no-waste foodstuffs from our new shop. So that's something to look out for.
Brilliant, yeah. So definitely get down to there and get your food.
And make sure to check out all of the songs we've talked about today on the Everybody Likes Music playlist.
Dave Richards, it's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you. Thank you very much for coming today, and we will see you very soon.
If you enjoyed that episode of Everybody Likes Music, don't forget to subscribe to the channel below and follow us on Spotify, where you can find all of the music that we talk about in the podcast, as well as some of James's and mine's favourite tracks.